We've been talking about the emerging new science of trees, which is changing the very definition of tree-ness. I mean, what if a tree is not a single entity, but a kind of hive mind? A networked intelligence, impossibly old, unimaginably vast, existing on a timescale we can barely comprehend. How do you even begin to wrap your head around that? Well, novelist Richard Powers took a stab in a monumental new novel called The Overstory. 500 plus pages, dozens of characters, multiple generations, all revolving around trees. Powers is a MacArthur Genius and National Book Award winner. He's written 11 previous novels, and this book is a major publishing event. Steve Paulson asked him to begin at the beginning.
First, there was nothing. Then there was everything. In a park above a western city after dusk, the air is raining messages. A woman sits on the ground, leaning against a pine. Its bark presses hard against her back. Its needles scent the air, and a force hums in the heart of the wood. Her ears tune down to the lowest frequencies. The tree is saying things, in words before words. It says, "Sun and water are questions endlessly worth answering." It says, "A good answer must be reinvented many times from scratch." It says, "Every piece of earth needs a new way to grip it. A thing can travel everywhere just by holding still." The woman does exactly that. Signals rain down around her like seeds. Talk runs far afield tonight. The bends in the alders speak of long-ago disasters. Spikes of pale chinkapin flowers shake down their pollen. Soon, they will turn into spiny fruits. Laurels insist that even death is nothing to lose sleep over. Something in the air's scent commands the woman. Close your eyes and think of a willow. The weeping you see will be wrong. Picture an acacia thorn. Nothing in your thought will be sharp enough. What hovers right above you? What floats over your head right now? Now. Your kind never sees us whole. You miss the half of it, and more. There's always as much below ground as above. That's the trouble with people, their root problem. Life runs alongside them, unseen, right here. Creating the soil, cycling water, trading in nutrients, making weather, building atmosphere, feeding and curing and sheltering more kinds of creatures than people know how to count. A chorus of living wood sings to the woman, "If your mind were only a slightly greener thing, we'd drown you in meaning." The pine she leans against says, "Listen, there's something you need to hear."
Wow, that is wonderful. What a great setup to the book.
Thanks for choosing it.
Yeah. You know, I'm guessing that most novelists who want to write about the more than human world would write about animals because we can kind of identify with them. Why did you want to write about trees?
You know, it's interesting that you said how much easier animal empathy identification is. Of course, that's the way we've been shaped by natural selection to be extremely sensitive to things that look like us, things about our size, things that move on our time frame, and that empathy is only grudgingly given outwards beyond the circle of the human. And I thought if we really want to get to this heart of why we feel so alone here, what psychologists call species loneliness, that I should take the problem directly in hand and say, what would it take for a human being like me to actually look at a plant, to look at a tree and say, I will give this the sanctity that I ordinarily only give to my own kind. It's a big challenge.
Was your goal then to create empathy for trees?
I think it was the goal of the book, and I would also call it a necessary first step for whatever transformation is going to be required of us to live stably on this earth. Originally, I thought it would be marvelous to try to write a novel where the trees themselves were the characters. That's a bit of a technical challenge.
And, yeah. Well, Tolkien did it, I suppose, with the Ents.
With the Ents,
in
yeah.
Lord of the Rings. I didn't, with that in the back of your mind?
The Ents were a great source of inspiration for me. Slow to anger, slow to act, but when they do, you want them on your side.
Right, yeah. Yeah. You obviously did a ton of research for this book. It is filled with scientific details, especially about the biology of trees. How many books did you read to be able to write this novel?
I read over 100 books, and that's everything from field guides and popular treatments of trees to more scientific, more esoteric books. But it was one of the happiest periods of my life, the 5 years that I spent reading and writing this book. I would say it kind of saved me in a way from my own increasing estrangement from the world of the present. I could not get enough of it. Every book that I read was like a walk in the forest.
What did you find most surprising about the science of trees?
You know, I didn't know much about it before I started. I had been somewhat tree blind myself for most of my life, that I took them for granted, thought of them probably more like resources than like creatures with agency
Wait, trees have agency?
Oh, they absolutely do. And they're social, they have memory, they talk to each other. They do so over the air, and they do so underground. A tree that's been attacked by insects, for instance, produces its own insecticides, and we've known that for a while. In this profusion of chemicals that the tree produces under attack are substances that go out over the air and are detected by nearby trees.
Wait, so basically they're telling other trees, watch out, I've been attacked by insects.
Yeah.
You better get ready.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who have compared this to a kind of shared immune system.
Wow.
And trees that have not been attacked get these signals and start to prepare their own preemptive insecticides. And that's a stunning thing, to think that natural selection has brought together this chemical mechanism that makes a forest a kind of superorganism in a way. A tree can produce chemical signals that call in an air force, that can alert another kind of insect to come and prey on the ones that are feeding on it.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah. It's a really stunning thing. And then the underground communication is truly mind-blowing. Fungus and trees form symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationships between themselves. It gets even crazier. I mean, some of these funguses make little lariats, let's say, out of their filaments, with which they trap invertebrates. They trap springtails in the ground, and they digest these animals, and they feed the nutrients back into the tree.
Wow.
And the fungus can connect trees at great distances. And in fact, it can connect trees of different species.
That's astonishing. I mean, it sounds like you're talking about tree intelligence here. Is that a word we can use?
It depends on the company. It's a word I have become increasingly comfortable using, and it's a word that pretty upstanding scientists have begun to think about. Even more conservative scientists have to step back from that word intelligence and say, if we mean by intelligence flexible, non-deterministic behavior in the face of a changing environment, appropriate, supple behavior that sensing, engaging, and responding accordingly, trees are doing that, and forests are doing that in a rich, aggregated way.
Hmm. Do we have anything to learn from trees?
Well, you know, step one is to retell our own history. So the first step is to realize how completely contingent on these other creatures our own development has been.
But there's another piece of this which has to do with time, because some trees live incredibly long lives. Some live hundreds of years. Some live over 1,000 years. I can't even really fathom.
Oh, Steve, it goes even older. The oldest continuous trunks, that is, the oldest single organism trees, many people cite the bristlecone pine, would be upward of 5,000 or 6,000 years. There's a celebrated tree in Norway that's been dying and resurrecting for over 9,000 years.
Wait, you're saying there's one tree that's been living for 9,000 years?
The root mass has been, and basal sprouts from that mass have been coming back since the Ice Age. There are clonal colonies of aspen. The great groves of aspen are all growing clonally out of the same root mass. You know, the root mass is on the order of 100,000 years old.
What do you do? It's just so mind-boggling. Yeah. Of course, there is a long history of animist cultures where pre-modern people have believed that trees are spiritual beings. And you strike me as a pretty hard-headed science guy. But I'm wondering if you've ever inhabited this kind of animist worldview.
The Overstory is in many ways an attempt to bring that hard-headed science into an intersection with the kinds of truths that older stories, animist stories, pantheist stories once told. This, to me, was the transformation, the eye-opening challenge that I was trying to respond to in putting this novel together. We're living in an age now that's dispensed with a lot of these old myths.
Right, they seem antiquated. They seem, those are when people didn't know any better, when they didn't know any science, that's what they believed.
Primitive, superstitious, yes, pre-scientific. But in fact, in dispensing with the things that are embodied in those myths, and retreating into a kind of pact between the hard-headed, rational, empirical approach to the world, that frame of mind unites in a way with a culture of individualism, a culture of commodity, where we adopt this idea that meaning somehow can only be a personal thing. If we live in this culture where the only source of meaning is what you can make for yourself, then we're going to have a kind of literature that doesn't travel very far beyond either the psychological, the crises of individual people trying to come to terms with their own conflicted interior ambivalence, or the literature of the sociological or political.
You're basically saying that, the contemporary novel really does not know how to write about the natural world. It's too much, too overwhelming.
I'm saying that the contemporary literary novel has forgotten a third kind of dramatic conflict, which used to be at the heart and soul of most stories that we told ourselves. Not a person against their own self or two people against each other, but the hopes and fears and dreams of the entire human race trying to come to terms with all of the things that non-humans want. You see, I think we got lulled into a false sense of victory. We thought, okay, that kind of went out with Jack London. We've won that fight, right? We beat nature, and we're the last species standing, and everything else now is just a kind of subordinated resource to our project, to the human project. And that rips the heart out of us. That's what leaves us in this perpetual state of species loneliness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to give a taste of this. And one of your main characters is a tree biologist named Patricia Westerford. And she's the one who discovers that trees can communicate with each other. And there's the gorgeous passage where she's walking through a forest in, I think it's the Cascades in the state of Washington. And
that's right.
We see the world from her perspective. Could you read that?
Sure. Hemlock, grand fir, yellow cedar, Douglas fir, buttressed monster conifers disappear in the mist above her. Sitka spruces bulge out in burls as big as minivans. Pound for pound, a wood stronger than steel. A single trunk could fill a large logging truck. Even runts here are big enough to dominate an eastern forest. Clicks and chatter disturb the cathedral hush. The air is so twilight green she feels like she's underwater. It rains particles, spore clouds, broken webs and mammal dander, skeletonized mites, bits of insect frass and bird feather. Everything climbs over everything else, fighting for scraps of light. If she holds still too long, vines will overrun her. She walks in silence, crunching 10,000 invertebrates with every step, watching for tracks in a place where at least one of the native languages uses the same word for footprint and understanding. A bit of bushwhacking reveals the extent of the prodigious rot. Crumbling, creature-riddled bowls, decaying for centuries. Snags, gothic and twisted, silvery as inverted icicles. She has never inhaled such fecund putrefaction. The sheer mass of ever-dying life packed into each single cubic foot, woven together with fungal filaments and dew-betrayed spider webs, leaves her woozy. Death is everywhere, oppressive and beautiful. She sees why her kind will always dread these close, choked thickets, where the beauty of solo trees gives way to something massed, scary, and crazed. When the fable turns dark, when the slasher film builds to primal horror, this is where the doomed children and wayward adolescents must wander. There are things in here worse than wolves and witches. Primal fears that no amount of civilizing will ever tame. The prodigious forest pulls her along, past the trunk of an immense western red cedar. She addresses the cedar using words of the forest's first humans. Long life maker, I'm here. Down here. She feels foolish at first, but each word is a little easier than the next. Thank you for the baskets and the boxes. Thank you for the cradles, the beds, the diapers, canoes, paddles, harpoons and nets, poles, logs, posts, the rot-proof shakes and shingles, the kindling that will always light. Each new item is release and relief. Thank you, she says, following the ancient formula, for all these gifts that you have given. And still, not knowing how to stop, she adds, we're sorry. We didn't know how hard it is for you to grow back.
That is such a remarkable passage. You somehow managed to turn science into poetry. I don't know how you did that. One of my takeaways from your book is that once you really understand how amazing trees are, you can't look at the world in the same way anymore. Something changes, and there are ethical implications. I mean, most obviously, you know, problems with logging old growth forests, but it seems to go much further than that. Did anything change for you personally? I mean, did this change your life in any way?
Everything changed. I'm living in a new place because of this book. I moved my life to another part of the country. I've been reading and researching for the book for 5 years, and in the first couple of years, I kept reading about old growth and how phenomenally different it is to walk into an old growth forest compared to the 98% of the wooded area of the country, which is regrowth. I was stunned by the statistic that over 55% of the trees in North America are younger than 40 years old.
Really? Wow.
And I kept reading about these spectacular extant pockets of old growth eastern forest in the Smoky Mountains. And 3 years ago, I decided to go have a look. You know, the deeper into these patches of uncut forest that I went, the lower my draw just kept dropping. I just thought, this is my country. This is what this place looked like. And this whole continent was Alaska.
And so you moved to the Great Smoky Mountains.
I did. It just got under my skin. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so a year later, I went back down and I bought a house on the edge of the park. And I've been living there for 2 years ever since. And I will continue to live there now into the foreseeable future.
Novelist Richard Powers in conversation with Steve Paulson. Powers is a MacArthur Genius and National Book Award winner, and his latest novel is called The Overstory.